Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Support for WPR comes from Luther College in Decorah, where visitors can experience campus and learn about Luther's 60-plus academic programs, like engineering science, nursing, and music education. luther.edu/visit.
Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, April the 16th. So when's the last time you danced in the streets? It's been a while, has it? We'll wonder why that is, and we'll wonder what's happening to the group celebration this hour. I couldn't resist playing that song as we talk with the author of Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. Barbara Ehrenreich is our guest, and she will talk with us about why we aren't celebrating as groups as much anymore and why that matters. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. Barbara Ehrenreich is a social commentator, cultural historian. She is author of many books, including Nickeled and Dimed. Do you remember that one? Her latest is Dancing in the Streets, A Collective History of Joy. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy, and thanks for starting out with Martha and the Vandellas there.
That's right. You remember that. I couldn't remember who did that song.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, were you thinking of that song with the title?
Well, the song is actually a little different. It's Dancing in the Streets, singular. The book title is Dancing in the Streets, plural.
Oh, yeah, and that is...
It's not really plagiarism, all right?
And that's an important distinction, because what we are you're talking here is the group celebration.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and why...
And that's what they were singing about, too.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. You're saying that hers is Dancing in the Street.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought about when was the last time that I danced in the streets, you know? There are some festivals here in Madison and other communities in Wisconsin where, you know, you can walk around and there's bands playing and you can dance in the streets. Is that, do you think that those things are going by the wayside, though, those types of outdoor festivals?
Well, yes. As a general rule in our culture, things like that have been replaced by spectacles where most people are just an audience. Somebody else is doing the dancing, singing, storytelling or whatever, and we just sit or stand and listen and watch. That's been the general trend for hundreds of years now.
Yeah, and why is that?
Well, here's the big question of the book, and I should just start back a little bit, which is this all started when I realized in my readings of anthropology, and this is another side of my life, aside from the economic issues and everything. I just spend a lot of time on things I'm curious about. Mm-hmm. But I realized that there is or was a universal human tradition of festivity, including always these ingredients of 1, dancing and music, 2, costuming, masking, face or body painting, and 3, feasting, drinking, food sharing, something like that. Could be many other things, but those are the core elements. And you can find this going into the prehistoric era. You can find it, you know, at least 10,000 years ago, evidence of this sort of thing. It seems to have been, you know, present in every culture that anthropologists and explorers encountered as they went throughout the world from the 19th century on. So the big question of the book then is, well, what happened to it?
Mm-hmm.
Why so little today? And I say so little, you know, a nice benchmark would be to go back to France in the 14th century, where one out of 4 days of the year, not counting Sunday, was given over to some sort of festivity, you know, maybe pegged to a saint's name, a saint's day or something like that.
So there'd be a big group celebration.
Oh, yeah.
Every 4 days. Yeah.
Square, mm-hmm. you know, people would mm-hmm. be all dressed up and they would costume and dance into the night.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, people didn't have the attitude that you just lived to work. You worked so you could have these good times now and then.
Yeah. So, I mean, what were the factors that led to this, I don't know, the downfall of the group celebration?
Well, you can go way back into the ancient world and find concern over ecstatic forms of worship, say of the god Dionysus, the god of ecstasy. Worries from, you know, in that case it was women doing most of the reveling, and worries from men that this was going to get out of hand, that women should not be doing this, even though they were, you know, worshiping, which is a pious thing to do. And that concern, you know, flickers in and out for centuries. It's a concern that people will, you know, that the whole thing might tip over into some sort of uprising. Mm. There's a very common feature of a lot of festivities is mockery of the people in power. In late medieval carnivals in Europe, that meant, you know, people would dress up as priests and nuns and act in rather unseemly, possibly obscene ways, or have a king of fools that they would mock, you know, a sort of substitute for the actual king. So there's always that fear, and it was a justified fear because in, say, the 19th century Caribbean, slave revolts would tend to fall mm-hmm. at the time of Carnival.
Yeah, so I mean, and that's, I suppose, one of the reasons why, you know, you wonder whether it's a dance, if these group celebrations are on their way out. It is important. It's not just a matter of we're not having fun anymore. These group celebrations were fun, but they were more than fun.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, every situation is different. There's a lot of debate among historians about that, just that question, how much was fun, how much had a political edge to it. But there's always there seems to have always been something very frightening to people in power when ordinary people are having a great time in public. For one thing, it's kind of empowering to those ordinary people. If you've danced in the streets, you know that feeling. Hey, the streets belong to us. And look, we're all connected, and we're a kind of a community out here. That's something that people looking down from the tops of castles and the tops of skyscrapers have always been worried about.
Yeah. When you mentioned that men in particular were concerned that women were participating in these festivals, that was because they were afraid there'd be an uprising of women, or that they're afraid because of the sexual overtones of dancing in the streets?
Well, this was in a very religious context.
Mm-hmm.
The god of ecstasy, Dionysus, had to be worshipped by dancing and revelry. That's just a requirement. And so it was hard for men to say, hey, you can't do that. And yet they keep sort of worrying that this is a little bit out of line, that women shouldn't be acting like this. Now, that was the ancient Greeks. When you get to ancient Rome, they actually cracked down violently on the worship of Dionysus. They just say, oh, no, we're not going to have women doing this. It's corrupting the morality of our nation. They're going to drag men into it. They're dragging men into it, too. And this is not a fit activity for a Roman man.
We're talking with Barbara Ehrenreich about the importance of group celebrations, collective joy. Her latest book is Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, and we welcome your thoughts and questions for her at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We wonder if modern Americans have grown resistant to having fun together, and whether there's anything we can do to stop the group festival the group celebration from disappearing. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 20 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, April the 16th, talking with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. And Barbara Ehrenreich, I'm wondering why you decided to focus on this subject after we know a lot about your work on economics and social justice and even war. All of a sudden, dancing in the streets, why?
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. I was working on this book before I ever did Nickel and Dimed.
Mm-hmm.
And I interrupted the research for this book, which took about 8 years, to do Nickel and Dimed and then Bait and Switch, you know, and many, many other things in the line of journalism and activism, too. So this was ongoing. And I think, to me, it's a very important question as somebody who wants to see social change, and that is how do people get together and develop the courage together to make change? And sort of to my surprise, you know, one answer is has to do with this festive spirit and tradition, which goes back so far in, well, even human evolution.
Yeah. Have we lost the festive spirit entirely, or do...
No, you know, it keeps coming back, even in a society as repressed as ours is and as... you know, committed to just watching spectacles rather than, like television, for example, rather than participating in things, it keeps coming up. One example that I devote a lot of time to in the book is, or a whole chapter anyway, is what I call the carnivalization of sports events.
Oh, yeah. A Green Bay Packers tailgate party, you see all of, all of this stuff.
You see, you know, you've got the, you've got the music, because rock and roll is, you know, now a big part of sports events. It's piped in. You have the costuming, whether that's a cheese head or a face paint or team colors. And you've even got a kind of dance in the form of the wave, you know, a rhythmic synchronized motion that 50,000 people can perform at once, which is kind of fascinating. So that's one example. And then people keep inventing new festivities, like the Burning Man Festival in Nevada every summer.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Well, you've heard of that. And or the Berlin Love Parade, which is a great big rock and roll blowout in the streets. You know, and the more I travel around talking about this book, the more things I hear about that I didn't know about, where people have sort of gotten together and created their own little festive tradition.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of folks that we have on the line right now with questions or maybe examples. Let's see. Renee in Madison. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I came from parents who were known to, they would dance around the kitchen and if music was on that they liked and stuff, and my grandparents danced. And I love to dance. And the sad thing is, it does seem like the younger generation is not always so willing to let mom dance. Mm-hmm. I've been known to embarrass my boys. It's like, it's not as, I don't know, it used to be people were open and you could joyously dance and not worry about what other people think. And now sometimes it's like, you know, everybody just looks at you like you're stupid.
and maybe people feeling embarrassed don't get up there and dance. And Barbara Ehrenreich?
Yeah, you know, one thing I could think contributes to that kind of embarrassment right now is this show, Dancing with the Stars, where dancing is it's a very angst-ridden contest. You know, who will trip? Who will, you know? And it just reinforces all the terror I felt when I was a kid and had to take ballroom dancing lessons. If you go to a true festivity, say in Brazil, in Rio, and I did see, I wasn't ever at Carnival, but I did see a samba team, a samba school practicing in the streets. And it's people of all ages. You know, from people who might have been in their 80s to four-year-olds, and absolutely no self-consciousness about it.
And that's the way it should be.
Like
it's just great. It's great to dance. Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Renee, for the call. Kurt in Earl, hello, you're on the air.
Hi. In Barbara's most recent essay, Reclaiming What Makes Us Human, she talked a lot about civilization and the elites squashing the festivities of the common people. And there's this growing movement with thinkers like Dan O'Quinn and Derek Jensen leading it that says we need to move beyond or take down civilization. And Jensen defines taking down civilization as stopping the flow of resources and money from the poor to the rich. And I was wondering, do we need to have that? Does that have to happen for the powers that be to stop squashing these festivities? I mean, for a contemporary example is like the Native American ghost dance that was pretty much squashed the last century. So I was wondering.
Who's squashing the celebrations, Barbara Ehrenreich?
Well, the ghost dance was actually very peaceful in its ideology. It was about not killing, not harming, and yet it terrified I guess it was the army, the U.S. Army, and it was absolutely crushed. He's right, but you're asking, I think, basically a very fundamental question, which is, can civilization coexist with a healthy and robust festive tradition? And I don't see why not. I think the fears of the overclasses are often exaggerated, and to the extent those fears are real, that's because there's already too much inequality, too much poverty at the bottom, and there's a reason to fear people getting together. But as you say, we've got to change that. May I point out here that Robin Hood appears to have been a character in late medieval English festivities. He was sort of like the spirit of festivity. Nice little connection there.
Thanks, Earl, for the call. So how do we change that?
Well, I think in our own time, there's nothing in the way of generating festivities and having them. And then if a crackdown comes, I think that has to be resisted. I think there are some things going on now that are worth looking at. Like there's the club scene, which is mainly for the young, and I think that's a shame. It should be more open, but it's mainly for the young, and it's always facing repression or police interference on the grounds that drugs are involved. But I think there's also just a dislike of people dancing in large groups.
Yeah. Boy, I'm trying to think of a local example, and there was a club that played a lot of hip-hop music, and there certainly was dancing in the streets, but there was also fighting in the streets and other things going on, and there was a big crackdown, and that club exists no more. And you think that's a shame?
I don't know the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, what brought on the fighting. But, it's another example right now would be the hyphy scene, H-Y-P-H-Y, scene in Oakland, California, which I don't know firsthand about. But this is a hip-hop scene involving dancing, involving a certain kind of costuming or style. It's very much coming from poor African Americans in Oakland. But what fascinates me is that what they mean by hyphy is this feeling of joy, of intense joy, that we can all get by through this sort of festive activity.
We'll go now to Andrea in Janesville. Good morning.
Good morning. I turned on the radio and I caught your interview, and I am absolutely thrilled that someone else, I've never talked about this to anyone, but on the 4th of July event in Chicago, when the event was over with, the people took over the streets from 6 and 8 lane highways, walking the opposite way that the arrows said, and stopped all traffic. And it didn't matter what the police said or did. We were going home now, and no one was going to make us stand on the corner. And it was so empowering. And I went, wow, these group events show that the people and the laws that we create for ourselves are to protect us, not to squelch us and to exploit us, and that we're in charge and we own this land and we own the street. Another time was Taking Back the Night in Madison. It's we will not be afraid, and we don't have to be intimidated, and we don't have to hide. And another one was my one football experience, the Wisconsin Badger game, and I'm like, wow, this is a religion of the people where you get the real feeling that you are a part of the whole and that we're not isolated and alone, and that the private is public. And then another one was I got a chance, a young friend of mine took me to the warehouse dance that happens all night that's supposedly illegal because supposedly of drugs. And that was a tribal experience of ecstasy. It just you and not drug ecstasy. The throbbing and beating of the music and the lights and this timelessness where you weren't going to be tossed out in an hour.
Oh.
And then you could just forget yourself, and it was just totally there was no self-consciousness about it because of the fantastic lighting as music and art, and it was just wonderful.
You're talking about a rave.
Yes, thank you. A rave, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and bless young people, and I hope they keep it up. But this, thank you for doing this book and for making the correlation between power of the people and festive carnival. And the powers that be better be nervous because they are exploiting us and taking us to the cleaners, and they are abusing their authority, and they are intimidating and manipulating us, and they are dividing and conquering, and they are turning us against each other. And when we get into the streets like that, we're like, that's all a lie, boys. You know, you need to back off. You need to...
Let's get Barbara Ehrenreich in on this, Andrea. Thank you for all those examples. What do you think, Barbara?
I don't know. Andrea maybe could have written this book. I don't know. You're expressing almost in the exact words what many people over the centuries have said, that feeling of self-loss, the feeling of empowerment. I mean, it's self-loss, but it also can be a feeling of great individuality, you know, because you're dancing your own way. You may be wearing your own kind of costume. So, and the sense of community formation. And that's what evolutionary biologists say is the reason, perhaps, that we have this strongly rooted, distinctively human attachment to music and dance, is that this was probably originally a way that our species could form larger groups than just family. And larger groups were needed for defense against animals, against, you know, maybe other bands of humans. And so that this is a very basic part of our legacy as human beings.
For example, in Janesville, they refuse to put money in the budget for things like the farmers market, and they have this huge list of things to get permission to have a block party, and it's just ridiculous. And then they charge you for the barriers and for bringing them and setting them up, and it just goes on and on. But when we had our 150th anniversary, all of the people just said, you know what, there's 10 of you, the administration, and there's 1,000 of us, and you're not going to stop us from celebrating this event. And they just, everybody did as they pleased, and every group just came out and did their thing, and they just did it. And the whole city came out of their isolated little houses and just said, you know, stop, we're celebrating. It was incredible. It was like true community again.
This is Madison?
Janesville.
Yeah, that's a little town south of Madison.
Supposedly
wow.
Little, but
yeah.
They use big city politics to keep the people
right,
scared and isolated and quiet and demure. And yes, so that was exciting, too. I'm like, ooh, there is community here. They didn't kill it.
Thank you very much, Andrea. Appreciate all those examples. So the spirit is still alive in Janesville. Judy in Reedstown is with us next. Hi, Judy. You're on the air.
Hi. My question might be sort of dull after that. I was interested in the anthropology that your guest has done, and I have two questions about dance festivals. Well, I call them dance festivals that I saw in Europe a long time ago that involved the dancers doing this sort of ritual step that goes on for hours and hours, and they hold the ends of a napkin or a handkerchief between the couples, and one is an astronaut in Luxembourg, and another one was in Barcelona, and the one in Echternach might have been a saint's day, but I don't know the story behind the Barcelona one. I wonder if you know anything about that. And before I sign off, I have to tell you that I guess I better get more rebellious. I look at what's happening today in our country, and I think I don't have much to dance in the streets about. Maybe a pitchfork, but not a dance.
No, I think, Judy, that a dance is not a suitable form of protest in all cases. I don't know about the specific kinds of dancing you refer to in Europe, but, you know, a lot has survived, more so in Southern Europe than in Northern Europe, because Northern Europe was hit by the Reformation, and the Protestants were real killjoys when it came to this sort of thing. They just simply banned carnival, you know, Saints' Day celebrations, church fundraising celebrations. Everything went when the Puritans came in, the Puritanical Protestants, that is. But there are these, there's much more left if you're in Spain or Italy.
Yeah. And I guess what about there's not a whole lot to dance about? I know you said dance is not a proper form of protest in all cases, but maybe people don't feel like group celebrations when there's so much to worry about.
Well, one thing I would point to is the carnivalization of protest, which I think has been going on since 1999 or so, when there was a big Seattle protest against the World Trade Organization, and that was very striking, very different from protests of the 60s. People were many were in costume. There was dancing in the streets. There was frisbee playing in the streets. It had all the hallmarks of a traditional festivity, although, you know, the message was very strong, that the world is too, cruelly divided between the rich and the poor, and the WTO, the demonstrators are saying, contributes to that. And since then, in recent protests I have seen or been to about the war in Iraq even, there has been more of this carnival spirit than I recall from the 60s. So, yeah, there can be an edge to it.
Yeah. Thanks again, Judy. Shay in Madison is with us. Hi, Shay.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of add to the point of, the control issues of the people in power and the people on the street. And I think that's a really valid point to make. But I guess I remember when I was a kid in the 70s going to numerous festivals. I mean, just it seemed like every weekend we had somewhere to go. There was some kind of festival. And, you know, there would be street musicians and there would be people juggling and there'd be lots of free entertainment. And it was just, you know, so much fun. And, you know, now, if I go to a street festival now with my child, everything costs money, and it's usually sponsored pretty heavily by, you know, many corporate sponsors, and I guess I feel kind of cynical. I feel kind of like a chump to be there, and, you know, it's like, you know, on one hand, maybe the celebration was oppressed by the ones in power, but on the other hand, it was also co-opted and sold back to us, and it's definitely not the same as it was when I was a kid.
Yeah, I've seen the same sort of thing. In Key West has an annual Fantasy Fest the end of October, and when I originally saw that, it was very creative. People put so much effort into their costumes. See, everybody parades down the main street and dances. People put a lot of effort into their dance steps, their music. It was a time when ordinary people could shine. And then in recent years, I didn't stay because it's sponsored by Budweiser now. There's much less creativity. It's more about just drinking till you vomit, you know, in the streets, or taking off your clothes, which is not the same as costuming. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that there's a tension about that goes back and forth. Yes, corporate interests might try to take over festivities and sell them back to us, but then we have to recreate genuine ones again.
Our guest is Barbara Ehrenreich. She is the author of Dancing in the Streets, A History of collective joy. 1-800-642-1234. Our number if you'd like to talk with us about the joys of group celebration and what's happening to group celebration and whether or not we can keep them from disappearing. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guest will discuss Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, Don Imus, stem cell research, and more headlines from last week's news coming up after 9 o'clock. By the way, tomorrow we will be carrying Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez's testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee. That testimony begins at 9 o'clock and is going to last pretty much all day. So we will carry National Public Radio's coverage of this testimony, and we'll follow up with talk shows with Ben Marins and tomorrow morning on my program as well. By the way, Chapter a Day fans, this does preempt Chapter a Day at 12:30 tomorrow, but you will be able to hear the program online. You can go to WPR.org, or it is repeated as well at night at 11 o'clock at night. We're talking with Barbara Ehrenreich for the rest of this hour. She is a social commentator, a cultural historian, the author of many different books. Her latest is Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. Our next caller is Glenn in Stoughton. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just wanted to give two quick examples of this whole group aesthetic. One of them that I'm taking part in is an organization called Dr. Sketchies. It's a group that formed in New York. And it has spread out to a number of cities, and including Madison. And what it is there's a group of artists who are kind of notoriously introverted and solitary get together in an establishment, in this case the High Noon Saloon, and we draw a live burlesque model. The model is in costume. The participants are in costume. There's dancing. There's all sorts of things like that. It's a way to just to get people who are normally just sitting at home working over a drawing table to get together and socialize and share ideas and share tips and all sorts of things. And the other one is the Wisconsin Film Festival that I just also took part in. Again, rather than buying, you know, some corporation's DVDs and buying a big screen TV, it was encouraging to see so many people wanting to get together and take part in you know, enjoying these movies together and listening to some of the conversations that I heard in line. And it was just great. I mean, none of this would have happened if people were just sitting at home doing their own thing, which is what it seems like the corporations want us to do, just buy their stuff and go home with it.
Barbara Ehrenreich, talk a little bit more about the importance of that group bonding.
Well, yeah, and what Glenn is also raising is how privatized and atomized our lives are. You know, how little interaction we normally have with either neighbors or strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that festivities overcame. In fact, I finally realized it's a way to look at all the masking that and costuming that has gone on in these things in every culture is not just that the mask offers anonymity and makes the neighbor seem like somebody strange, but it means that you can't tell the difference between a stranger and a neighbor. You know, a stranger fits in too. And that's, we just don't have much of that. We are, I think, encouraged to stay home, turn on the TV, whether, you know, get into the internet and keep to yourself. On the internet you might be interacting with other people, but not in a very physical or direct way.
Yeah. Glenn, thanks a lot for the call. Buck in Madison is with us now. Hi, Buck.
I compliment the author for her book. I'm looking at it. I finally got it back from my wife. Our library bought a lot of copies, and there's still people backed up waiting for me to finish. So, good job. Secondly, a lot of joy is meta-politics. Like dreams, like block parties, it is outside the purview of the guys in the skyscrapers on the castle. And thirdly, have you considered including complaints choirs? Birmingham, Pittsburgh, and Scandinavia have people who gather together to put their complaints in verse, sing, and then put them on the internet, and they are a hoot. Complaints choirs.
Huh. How do you find these on the internet? Just Google complaints choirs?
Well, it should be ixquick, but Google if you must. You know, Google will keep your question in their repository forever. Ixquick is Dutch. They say, now we keep it for 2 days.
All right. Anyway, you haven't heard of these complaints choirs, Barbara
no,
Ehrenreich.
I've gone on.
Well, but we know you've heard about it, but I mean, Barbara Ehrenreich, you haven't heard about complaints choirs. Yeah.
And this is a joyful but wry way to complain about your bus service or the price of beer.
Well, we'll look into that other times, Buck.
It is
but,
like roasting the sardine, right?
I guess so. I thought Buck was going to talk about block parties, and he didn't. He brought up a lot of things, but not block parties. The neighborhood block party, Barbara Ehrenreich, is that a thing of the past?
No. People keep, regenerating them one way or another. I have participated in a few, but I think that's the kind of thing that you can just do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one caller mentioned that the authorities will probably put you through a lot of hoops about various restrictions, but maybe it's worth, pushing back a little bit and saying, well, we really want to do this.
In terms of modern cultures, we know about Carnival in Brazil. Is it, is Latin America more joyous than North America?
Yes, I would say it's a funny, to sound so positive about a vast generalization like that. But yes, I mean, Latin America, Southern Europe, was not as affected by the Reformation, by Puritanism. And Puritanism, is not just about sex. It's about, very much about things like dancing and having fun in public forums. So I would say probably yes. Like, it took North Americans a long time to carnivalize their sports events. Well, Brazilians had been dancing and costuming at soccer games way before that.
Yeah. Do you link the lack of group celebrations with the epidemic of depression that we're seeing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was just struck by the fact that in the 17th century, throughout Europe, that there was concern about what they called melancholy. And the more you read about what they were identifying as melancholy, the more it sounds like what we call depression. And this seemed to fit in, just in terms of timing, with the big crackdown on traditional festivities. In fact, a lot of contemporaries saw it that way, like John Burton, who wrote the famous book, The Anatomy of Melancholy, that he was saying, people used to dance a lot and sing, and things that are being taken away from us right now, and that's got to have something to do with melancholy. I don't think the cause and effect thing is that simple, that you just take away festivities and people get depressed. But I do think that festivities and revelry and ecstatic group activities have been used by various cultures as a cure for depression again and again. And we gave up that cure and substituted pills.
Mm. Bob in Duluth is with us now. Hello.
Hello. Fantastic topic. I teach at a local community college up here, and with my students, I'm talking with this all the time because of the fact that I see that isolationism where you're sitting in front of a computer screen or texting on the phone. You're not having that one-to-one or even a broader communication with, the outside public. And I guess for me, how I look at it is, there used to be, or there still is, a festival in Duluth, a Blues Front Bay Festival. Blues music used to be free, people used to bring dogs, cats, snakes, whatever, to the festival. And, you know, now the city of Duluth and the festival promoters got into a big row because of who got the biggest cut, you know, and it's all about money. And, you know, the facts of the matter is I used to go to Grateful Dead concerts long time ago. We used to just have a beautiful time dancing. Whether it was drug-induced or not doesn't really make a point. But when I went to the last Dead concert a year or so back, it was really sad because there was just me and another old-timer that were dancing, and all these kids were looking at us like we were nuts. And, you know, it's that thing about the youth need to be brought up into this fact that they can dance, that they don't have to be oppressed. And there's so much oppression going on that leads to depression. Mm. And I'll just take my answer off the air.
Barbara Ehrenreich?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. My son was a Deadhead when he was in his teens, and he reported it was to me that it was more like being part of a community. You know, people just travel from concert to concert. You'd see the same people again and again, and there was a sense of being part of something much bigger than yourself, a sense reinforced by dancing into even, you know, this wonderful state of self-loss. I worry about young people when I hear, you know, that the big trend on college campuses has been binge drinking. Well, I have to think, where's the fun in that? You know, what happened? What happened to the dancing? What happened to all the other ingredients of a great good time? Just drinking till you fall down kind of misses the point.
Yeah, seems there's costuming and food and dancing and all sorts of great group celebration stuff at the Halloween celebration in Madison, but there's also maybe way, way, way too much drinking.
Uh-huh. Well, as long as people can stay on their feet to dance.
Yeah, I mean, all right. Matt in Marquette is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I would like to share an experience that I had a couple of years ago at a music festival up in Marquette. Every year at the Hiawatha Festival late at night, there's a drum circle in a certain part of the park. And it's very much kind of a cumulative, ecstatic group experience like you're talking about. But there's another side to that kind of group mentality that I found really disturbing, because they usually at like 1 or 2 in the morning, the security people go around and ask the drummers to stop because everybody through the rest of the park is trying to sleep. And I happened to be there when that was going on one year, and I remember having the distinct impression that if one of the group leaders had kind of given the okay, the initial sense of resentment at being asked to stop could easily have been turned into a mob mentality, and I really had a strong sense that that group of drummers would have beaten up the security people if somebody had told them to. Do you have any thoughts about kind of the darker side of that group mentality?
Well, it's an interesting question, Matt. I mean, in the history of festivities, there are many, many occasions where the authorities would try to, you know, stop it, and that would turn into a melee, into fighting back against the authorities. You know, and I'm not saying, you know, this is a good thing, an admirable thing, but this is part of the tension in festivities, where people begin to think, the streets are ours, we can have a good time, we're intensely bonded through this experience, and we'll push back if you try to stop us.
Thank you very much, Matt. Harriet in Duluth, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, this is Harriet.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good. I'm so delighted to have picked this up, and I'm a great fan of what you've written in the past, Barbara, and I want to read this book very much. My experience with ecstatic dancing is through the Dances of Universal Peace, which was developed by a rabbi in the 1960s in San Francisco. He was also a murshid, or a teacher, within Sufism, which is a mystical branch of the Muslim religion. And this is something very widespread all over the United States. I found it in Hilo, Hawaii, There's a major camp in Maui. When I moved to Southern California, there were dances going on weekly. And in the Ozarks, where I've lived for the last 9 years until I moved back to Duluth, there's two major, incredible, empowering, and delightful celebration dances in spring and fall. And the spring one brings about 350 people. The fall one, maybe, you know, 150. It's been going on for about 25 years. And this is a huge camp that draws people from all around the United States, and the teachers are from Hawaii this year. And they're very, very beautiful dancing, and I can't say they're not 100% non-drug, but I'd say they're about 80 to 90% non-drug, with a bunch of former hippies who may have used drugs. And so Sufism and the dances of universal peace are powerful, and I don't know, I'll be so interested to see if you discuss that in your book.
Oh, well, thank you for telling us about that, Harriet. I didn't know about this. But, yes, Sufism is a very large stream of Islam. And the antagonistic stream is Wahhabism, the kind of very puritanical and harsh interpretation of Islam that you find in Saudi Arabia or among within Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. And it's interesting that when the Taliban took power in the 1990s in Afghanistan, the first group they went after was the Sufists, you know, banning dance, because Sufists have, you know, practice ecstatic dancing. Theirs is a religious tradition associated with many festivities, which the Wahhabists just terribly cracked down on. So, yes, there's a chapter in my book on that, because it's not only the Protestants who have been puritanical opponents of festivities. It's the Wahhabists.
Harriet, thank you. Barbara in Madison will be our last caller. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I'm very interested in this topic, but I wanted to introduce another component to the discussion, and that is cultural and racial differences. My daughter, who is a college student on a predominantly white campus, reports that when they had a discussion about what are some of the barriers to integration at the school, African-American students reported that white students' idea of going out and having a good time was going out and getting really drunk, and their idea of going out and having a good time was dancing. Mm. And I've seen with historically black colleges that ritualized dancing is very much part of, you know, the cultural scene.
I'm sorry, we have less than a minute for a reaction or response to that, Barbara Ehrenreich.
Well, I would say that's proof of African American cultural superiority, if we needed any.
Well, you know, we'll leave it there, and thank you very much for being with us. Barbara Ehrenreich is author of Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. Barbara Ehrenreich is a social commentator, cultural historian, author of many books, including Nickeled and Dimed. We thank her for being with us. We thank Carmen Jackson for producing the hour and Leo Duran for on-air production, and to you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.